You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This month, we talk all things books set in Brighton. We discuss Missing Theatre with Jamie West, Tattoo Conventions with Alison Belsham, all things romantic comedies set in Brighton and Hove with Sue Tedden, and we discuss our LGBT history with Darren Kay, author of The Brightonians. The show is also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any suggestions or would like to be featured on the show, you can email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Or Jamie West's new book, Death on the Pier, is set in Brighton, and Jamie joins us on the show to talk about writing Brighton in the 1930s. Jamie, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you for having me on. I'm really excited to be here.
Why did you decide to set Death on the Pier, which is first in the Bertie Carroll series, in Brighton?
It's funny. I mean, I have no particular personal connection to Brighton, I'm afraid to say. I'd love to be a local author and live down by the sea, but unfortunately, because of my work, I live up in London. So, but I've obviously visited there several times over the years, and obviously I was drawn to the pier. I guess it's just such an iconic, it's full of stuff as well, which isn't necessarily the case for piers, so it's really full of life, and it's always kind of grabbed my attention. It's such a focal point down there on the coast, so the pier is what came first initially. I was kind of looking what would be a good place to set a murder mystery, and the end of a pier perhaps is like a good closed off location. And then of course, as I started looking into Brighton Pier more and discovering there was a theatre at the end of it, I'm obsessed with lost theatres, so the whole thing, from that point onwards, the whole thing just fell into place. You know, I love theatre, I love murder mysteries. Obviously at some point I was just going to end up writing a murder mystery set in a theatre. It was just it had to be done.
So I must say, I've never ever heard anyone say I'm obsessed with lost theatres. Can you just expand on that a bit and talk about kind of how that interest has developed?
As soon as you know they exist, you see them absolutely everywhere. I mean, there's about 1,000 theatres in this country today, ranging from tiny little community venues up to the big West End theatres and big touring houses around the UK. And they're beautiful historic buildings. You know, they're great. But there are ones that over time, you know, have been, as the theatre industry has kind of waned, it stopped being the mass entertainment it once was because of radio and TV have kind of taken over. So they have closed down, and some of them have been repurposed, but they're all over the place. Some of them, you know, are churches, synagogues, mosques, Wetherspoons, pubs, supermarkets in one case. When I used to work on Book of Mormon, the Tesco's we used to go to is in an old theatre building. You come out of Tesco's and you look up and there's a really ornately carved exit sign above the exit sign of the Tesco's. And I was like, oh, that's weird. That looks a bit like a theatre. So of course I go and look into it and look it up, and it was theatre. So they're all over the place, and you can just spot, you can spot a theatre. Once you know what to look for, you can just spot them. And like I said, they are all over the place.
So what is something that you found out about this forgotten theatre that we might not know?
Well, it's funny because obviously I did a lot of research into it. I went to the Keep in Brighton to look at architects' plans and records and all of that stuff. And that was good for finding out what it was like in the 1930s, because it was important to me, if my goal is to resurrect these theatres in these books, I want them to be, you know, accurate. I don't just want to make up a fantasy theatre. And I also worked with the Theatres Trust. During COVID, their archives were closed to the public, but they were really great in emailing me some things over. And they had a lot of modern things from the 1980s. And there was a bit of a scandal because the theatre is still supposed to be there today. It was Grade 2 listed. It should have been safe. And they kind of demolished it temporarily, was the idea, so they could repair the pier. And the idea was that it was put back, but it never happened. And the owners sort of mislaid it. No one knows if they did it deliberately or not, but it sort of disappeared. So it has, you know, a unique place in being that it was a lost theatre that was truly lost. It was mislaid, and no one knows where it was, and it was gorgeous. I mean, it's such a shame because shortly before it was demolished, it was described as the finest surviving example of a theatre at the end of a pier in the country. So it's an absolute tragedy that it was lost.
You have immortalised it in the first book in your series, Death on the Pier. Can we hear some, please, Jamie?
Yes, I shall give it a go. So this is from the first chapter, when Bertie, who's my lead character, arrives at the pier. The Palace Pier Theatre was a decent size. Other than the vast hippodrome, it was probably the largest stage in Brighton. It had a capacity that was comparable to most regional theatres and could easily accommodate shows on the first-class touring circuit. A year or two earlier, another one of Bertie's productions had visited the theatre as part of its national tour. It wasn't a popular venue to play at. You couldn't drive vehicles onto the pier, so any scenery and costumes had to be carried the entire length of the wooden deck by hand. The local crew were used to this awkward endeavour, although the touring stage manager had found the load-in rather stressful. He remained in constant fear that a strong gust of wind might catch one of the flats the large canvases had stretched over a wooden frame to form the scenery, and sail-like, it would be whipped out over the railings and out to sea. Inside the auditorium, the sounds of the outside world were dulled a little, but waves could still be heard underfoot. If you left aside the noise, there were no real clues that this was a theatre sitting a little way out into the English Channel. The cream and brown paint colours of the auditorium were the mainstay of theatre interior design up and down the country. Nicotine staining from the many years of cigarette smoke rising from the audience had tinged the walls from a clean cream to a murkier shade of yellow. Bertie manoeuvred his way around a white column, though it was more of a pole, which was supporting the underside of the circle above it, and was rather awkwardly positioned in the centre of the aisle. As he emerged from under the cover of the circle, the full height of the auditorium was revealed. The side walls crept up to join a gently arcing ceiling, which followed the curved construction of the roof. It would have been a complete semicircle if it wasn't interrupted by a flat section of ceiling which stretched the entire length of the room. He was surprised to see that the majority of the flat ceiling wasn't the usual painted plaster, but glass. Above the seats in the circle, there were several large panels filled with dozens of square panes of glass. These panels stretched down towards the stage until the circle gave way to the stalls below and it transitioned into a magnificent, multicoloured, stained-glass dome. Even with the lights turned off, he could tell that when it was illuminated from behind, it must have looked spectacular. He could just make out the different shades, green, blue and yellow, with the central band of the dome formed by clear frosted glass. As he moved, the pieces of coloured glass caught the light at different angles, causing it to shimmer and sparkle. Circular ceiling lights with a milky opal finish were dotted in a ring around the outside of the dome. Bertie took one last look behind him, noticing a metal box hanging on the front of the circle rail with round holes cut in it. From within, bright spotlights illuminated the scene in front of him. He finally allowed his eyes to be drawn towards the stage, where a rehearsal was currently in progress. It was not going well.
So, Jamie, Death on the Pier, amongst many other things, explores what it's like to be part of the LGBT plus community in the 1930s. Can you talk a bit about what that would have been like?
It's funny because obviously, as modern readers, we're reading this book through the lens of modern day homosexuality. And it was very different back then. Not the fact that it was illegal, although it was sort of a bit unknown. It wasn't, people wouldn't necessarily assume, even Bertie, who is written, you know, explicitly as gay, people around him wouldn't necessarily have assumed that. It was just not really a known thing, even though it was very underground and hidden. So the relationship between the two characters, although I don't like to call it a relationship yet, because we don't quite know where it's going, but it's a long, slow burn, I think, and it's going to be very interesting to see how those two characters develop, and whether that friendship, that close friendship, develops into something more or not. So yeah, I'm intrigued to live through a few more murder mysteries with these two and see where it goes.
Did you use real Brighton murders when writing this book?
No, I didn't actually. It's a lot of the inspiration for the murder is kind of from my experience in the theatre, because it has always terrified me. And we've seen, even recently with films like Rust and the accident that happened on the set of that film. But more generally, when you've got guns, I've done shows with guns and knives and simulated hangings and things, and it's always chilled me. How do you know if that's gone wrong? You know, we're working with great actors. They're acting like they've been shot or stabbed, or they're acting like they're suffocating. You know, all these horrible things. And obviously, everyone just gets a little bit more serious backstage when these things start to happen, necessarily so. But there's always just a little niggle in the back of my head. It's like, how do we know that this is not real? We just don't. And that was really the impetus to write the murder and how it evolves in this book.
Jamie, thank you so much for coming on today. How can we find and follow you and grab a copy of Death on the Pier?
Well, you can follow me on social media. This is Jamie West everywhere, on Twitter or Instagram or even TikTok, where I've started getting into it, posting little videos of theatre history, which is kind of fun. And you can buy my book at any bookshop. So if you've got a favourite bookshop, they should be able to order it in for you. Go and support your local bookshops. But of course, you can get it quite easily on Amazon and pre-order it today on Amazon Kindle. And the paperback will be available on Amazon as well from the 10th of October.
Hove-based Sue Tedden's new book, The Pre-Love Club, is set in Brighton and out now. Sue, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is your second book, but your first one set in Brighton. Why did you decide to set it here?
Well, they talk about writing what you know, but it just seemed the obvious thing to do. It was an idea I've had a long time ago. And in its first iteration, it was two people who meet online. And that was for a radio drama that was produced by Radio 4 a few years ago. But when I realised I wanted them to meet in the flesh and I wanted to tell a much more expanded story, it made sense for Ned to live in Poets Corner in Hove and for Gemma to live in Bevendine. So it's like, you know, you've got the whole, for people who don't know Brighton and Hove, that's a million miles apart. And it just seemed like quite a nice symbolic way of doing it, so that they were each side of the city.
Let's talk a bit about The Pre-Love Club, romantic comedy set in Brighton and Hove. What first sparked the idea?
Well, you have to go back a long way for this, because I did a script writing class while I was still a journalist, and we had an exercise where we had to write a scene for a play with the line, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" And I came up with this idea about a single father who has his daughter at weekends and never knows quite how to choreograph the moment she needs to use a public toilet. And he either goes in with her and looks like a pervert, or he stands outside the toilets and looks like a pervert. And this image always stuck with me. So in that version of it, which is a long, long, long time ago, long before the radio series, he meets a woman who says, "Look, I'll take her in." And that became Gemma, except in those days they had different names. So that's where the idea came from, about two people who joined forces, who are both single parents. And in the book version, Ned has his daughter at the weekends, and Gemma's kicking her heels because her son goes to his dad's on at the weekend. So she's got nothing to do at the weekend, and he's suddenly a dad at the weekend, and they sort of help each other out.
It's a wonderful, wonderful concept for a book. What has inspired you? I've heard you talk a bit about radio already, and I know that you have a background in screenwriting. What writers, screenwriters, TV, film have inspired your writing?
When I was starting, because I'm very old, there were writers like Alan Plater, and there were writers like Nora Ephron. I didn't actually know I was going to be writing a novel. It wasn't my game plan until about, I don't know, 6 years ago, but the script writing career was drying up a bit. So book-wise, I must confess, it's a terrible thing to confess on a book show, but I was a very poor reader. I was much more of a watcher of TV and film. So over the years, I've loved books like by people like Maggie O'Farrell, and David Nichols is a big influence. I like contemporary. I'm not great on historical, so I don't tell anyone, but I've never read any of the Hilary Mantel books. I know I should. Have you?
You know what? I've read one years ago, and I feel like if anything has come from her very untimely death, it's that I should definitely probably read more.
Yeah, me too. So I tend to like contemporary novels. I tend to like novels with a bit of spark and with a bit of humor and with a bit of, I suppose it's the sort of thing I like to write. Yeah, I mean, I always used to tell students, don't write what you wouldn't want to watch or hear on the radio. And same with writing a book, don't write a book you wouldn't want to read. So I think I probably like books which I would like to think are like with the kind of books I write.
Can you read us some, please, Sue, and just set the scene for us?
Yes. Well, this is Gemma has gone out for the weekend for a walk with a friend along the walk from the marina to Rottingdean, and she gets a call from her ex's new partner saying, "Can you come and pick up your son because they're a bit late, and you can come and pick them up here." Gemma knows all about the house where Joe now lives with his new partner Vicky because she looks online, she follows them on social media, she's a bit of a stalker. So this is her coming to pick up her son from Joe's house. Vicky texts me detailed directions for how to get to their place. She even includes a Google Map link. I can hardly tell her I've stared into her bedroom from the top deck of the number two bus more times than I dare to admit. I must stop doing that. Maybe this visit will get it out of my system, seeing her sofas, sniffing her soap. Joe's car is not parked in the driveway, still running late then. Typical. Back in the day, you were just late. Mobile phones are giving people permission to add running to make it sound like they're in demand rather than inconsiderate. I ring the doorbell and wait. I know what Vicky looks like. God knows I check her out on her Facebook page most days to see where she's been, whether she's tried out that new hairdresser a pal recommended or reactivated her gym membership. Ever since Joe dumped me, I've managed to avoid meeting her in the actual flesh, though. My walk with Roz has empowered me, and today I reckon I can do it. If I meet her, maybe I can finally stop hating her. Then again, why should I? She ruined my life. She stole my husband. She stole my life. Of course I hate her. She's shorter than I expected, and yes, it's a good haircut, but I won't tell her that. Chopped into the neck, subtle highlights with one of those feathery fringes that on me would highlight my flat screen forehead. She's dressed nicely too. Tight fit jeans, silk blouse with ruffles around the shoulders, fluffy polka dot slippers. I sense her giving me the once over too, and wish I wasn't wearing Joe's old t-shirt. Not that she knows it was his. It makes me feel vulnerable, unprepared, weak. Thanks ever so much, Gemma. I really appreciate this. She ushers me into the kitchen, which is bigger than I expected. I'll put the kettle on, or can I do an espresso? Then I notice the blood on the worktop, on a big wadge of kitchen paper and a tea towel, on the cuff of her blouse. She sees that I've seen and goes pale. She reveals a badly cut finger gushing blood. She sits with a lucky thump on a bar stool and gives an embarrassed little laugh. I shouldn't be allowed near tin cans. Honestly, look at the mess I've made. She wobbles a bit like she's going to faint. I just did it 2 minutes before you rang the doorbell. On a tin of tuna for Loopy, our cat. Sunday treat, I'm not very good with blood. And now she does faint, or at least swoon, and I have to catch her. Towel, I ask, when 2 seconds later her eyelids flutter open. Plasters? She waves at a cupboard above the sink, and there's a very snazzy first aid kit. Mine's an old biscuit tin with some perished band-aids. I must restock my biscuit tin. What if Kelvin cut himself badly? What kind of mother am I? She doesn't direct me to any towel, so I make do with the one hanging from a row of hooks by the sink, which spell out LOVE. I hate cutesy stuff like that. You just sit still and keep that towel pressed down.
It's absolutely lovely, Sue, and I can definitely see the Nora Ephron influence in your writing
Oh, good.
myself.
The thing with Gemma, which I have to explain, is where Ned is a bit of a twerp and he's really quite bruised by the fact that his wife just called it a day on their relationship. So he's quite gauche and he's not very observant, whereas Gemma is very bitter and very angry and very defensive. So whenever someone does want to make friends with her or start a relationship with her, she's very, very spiky, which explains just a little bit of her attitude to Vicky.
So you teach screenwriting. What are your top tips for anyone that's interested in writing for screen?
Well, I teach, it's more script writing than screenwriting, and over the last few years of teaching, it's been more radio script writing. But I think the rules apply to whatever kind of writing. I think the one I've already said about don't write what you wouldn't want to read. I think the thing I've always told students when they're anxious and they don't know what they've got to say is I write the best Sue Tedden scripts, books, whatever, in the whole world. No one else can write a Sue Tedden script like me. and you write the best Anna Burt book scripts, whatever. So whatever you don't know in practical terms, you are bringing, what you're bringing to the table is your unique take on the world. And I think that's quite reassuring to people who don't think they've got the tools, because you can learn the tools, but you haven't, only you have got that vision.
That's really kind of encouraging, really encouraging advice. Thank you very much. But what is next for you? What are you writing now?
It took me a while to get started on the next book because I hadn't realised quite what a gig it was, because when you write scripts, they're only about 8,000 words an hour, a 45-minute play. So to write 90,000 words just filled me with horror, but I've done it twice now, so I know I can do it. So I dragged my heels about starting the next one, but I am 10,000 words in, and it's another contemporary book. I can't set it in Brighton and Hove again, so at the moment, it's set in Eastbourne. And it's about four women who become friends. The working title is My New Best Friends. It's about making friends when you didn't think you were going to make friends anymore.
So how can we find and follow you and stay in the loop with when your next book will be out?
Right. Well, I don't know about the next book because it's such early days. I'm on Twitter as Sue Tedden. I'm on Instagram as Sue Tedden. Very imaginative. Something I wanted to mention. I'm on at the Shoreham Wordfest in a couple of weeks on October the 13th, talking about the Pre-Love Club. So I'm really pleased about that, to be talking at a local festival. Oh, and I've got a website, which is called www.suetedden.com.
And thank you very much for joining us, Sue.
Well, thank you very much. It's been really nice to talk to you.
Alison Belsham is the author of the Brighton Set Police Procedural Serial Killer Trilogy, published by Orion. Alison, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Why did you decide to set your trilogy here in Brighton?
When I first conceived of the idea of writing a trilogy based on sort of the tattooing world and murders taking place in the tattooing world, I had initially thought of setting it in London because that's where I was living at the time. And as I sort of started to plan it out and think about things, I wanted to have a scene at a tattoo conference, and Brighton has this amazing tattoo convention. London has one as well, but I'd been to the Brighton one, and also as I thought about it, I thought, hang on a minute, London is so big, and to set a book there, you have to kind of choose a corner of London, and it's not very, bits of London on their own are not terribly exciting. So it suddenly the penny dropped. I can have things happening at the Brighton Tattoo Convention, which is where the opening scene of the first book starts. And then I can set it in Brighton because there's a massive tattooing community in Brighton as well. So it just suddenly, it all clicked into place. And I knew Brighton from my childhood. I've been there many, many times. I love Brighton. And it just gave me a great excuse to have lots of research trips. So very happy with that decision.
Absolutely, absolutely. As someone who has received some of their best and worst tattoos in Brighton, I'm also a big fan of the tattoo scene here. So Alison, I really like to do this for authors who have written multiple books, and I like you to give your kind of elevator pitch for each book. So if I say the name in order of your trilogy, can you give us a little pitch for them? So let's start with the first, The Tattoo Thief.
Okay, so this is The Tattoo Thief, and this is the book that introduces my two main characters who run through the series. D.I. Francis Sullivan, who's a young detective inspector. This is his first case. And so he's really different from the other sort of police procedural heroes that you get. You know, he's not middle-aged. He's not forever swigging whiskey and moaning about his divorce or whatever. He starts off with this sort of bright, enthusiastic, wants to crack the case, but of course he's very inexperienced. The case kicks off with a body being found in a dumpster in the gardens of Brighton Pavilion, and it's the tattoos have been cut off it, and they realise they've got a killer on their hands who is taking tattoos off people. The person who found the body is the second character that becomes really central. Marnie Mullins is a tattoo artist, and she's a kind of fixture in Brighton. She's older than Francis. She knows everything about the tattooing world. And so he has to turn to her to be kind of guided into this world that is, you know, he has no tattoos and doesn't take a great view of them at the beginning of the book. And so they make a really unlikely couple, and they have to solve murder. So that's book one.
And then number two, Her Last Breath.
Number two, Her Last Breath. Having solved the first murder case, Marnie and Francis are again thrown together. There's another murder case that starts off, another serial killer in Brighton, and he's poisoning people with poison ink. He's tattooing people, and he puts poison in the tattoo ink, and he snatches young girls and he tattoos things on them, and then he lets them go and they're still alive. And two or three days later, they die because of this poison that he's put into the tattoo. So it's really horrendous, that killing. And Francis, of course, has to track him down and catch him. And the unfortunate thing is that there are things that suggest the killer might be Marnie's teenage son. And so Marnie, of course, is involved because Marnie has to prove that it's not her teenage son. And so once again, they're slightly at loggerheads and they're tracking the killer through Brighton, and all sorts of excitement happens.
Oh my gosh, I feel like breathlessly excited. And finally, The Embalmer, which is your most recent book in the trilogy.
This is the most recent one, and this is the third one in the trilogy. And once again, we've got another killer arriving in Brighton. You know, it's beginning to be like Midsummer Murders. But I don't know if you know the Natural History Museum in Brighton, that really funny little museum.
Booth Museum.
The Booth Museum, that's right. And it starts off there, and a mummified body appears in one of the museum cabinets. And when they look into it, you know, the museum manager is like, oh, what's the, you know, totally unexpected, what's going on, calls the police. When they look into it, they find that it's a freshly mummified body. It's not an ancient Egyptian mummified body. And someone has mummified this body and starts leaving, you know, when they mummify a body, they put the things like the heart and the liver and things like that into these jars called canopic jars. And this killer starts leaving canopic jars around the place in Brighton that they find. And he starts killing more people, of course. And once again, they're on the trail. Marnie is involved, but she's not involved in this case, because at the same time, Marnie has been accused of murder and has been arrested for murder. And Francis doesn't believe that she's done it. Of course he doesn't. Marnie is his great friend, and they've got a little thing going on and off thing. So, of course, he doesn't believe that she's the killer. So while he's trying to find one killer, he's also trying to clear Marnie's name of this other murder. And, of course, it's the same as usual, tearing around all sorts of places in Brighton and dead bodies popping up.
I am obsessed with this trilogy. I cannot wait to hang up this call and just start reading them on my Kindle. So can you read us a little bit from The Embalmer, please?
It's quite far into the book, but what happens is Francis gets a message from the killer, and it tells him to go up on the I-360, and Francis doesn't know why. So he rushes there, and he tells the manager to get all the people off and allow him to go into it alone and to raise it up to the top. And so this is it. He's going up now. Brighton shrank beneath him as the world expanded. He could see far along the coast to the east, to the marina, and way beyond it, the cliffs at Beachy Head. To the north, the city gave way to the soft undulations of the Downs, while the view to the west encompassed Hove Lawns with its angel statue and gold sandy beaches curving away into the distance. Returning to the east side of the pod, he looked down on the silver skin onion domes of the pavilion and then picked out the squat 1960s building that housed the police station in John Street. What was he looking for? He went across to the southern side. With the sun so low in the sky now, the sea shone like a mirror, making him squint and turn away. As they climbed higher still, a familiar feeling weighed in against his chest. He stepped back from the curved glass with its steel railing. He couldn't look straight down now, only out in the distance. He carried on back until he could feel the firm edge of the bar behind him. He put his arms out to either side to grip its reassuring surface. He'd always suffered from vertigo, but it seemed even worse with the vestiges of a hangover. He turned away from the view and watched the steel grid-like surface of the tower passing as the platform continued to move up. It was like being inside a glass lift. He took deep breaths and went around the bar to help himself to some water. Finally, the I-360 juddered to a halt. It was silent and he was completely alone, more than 150 metres above the city. It didn't make sense. No one could meet him up here unless they'd come up with him. He walked all the way around and checked behind the bar. For a second, paranoia got the better of him. Could there be someone on the other side of the central tower, moving around silently to always remain out of sight? He sprinted round the platform a couple of times until he was convinced he was alone. Sweat ran from his brow into his eyes and he wiped it away with a gesture of frustration. What was he meant to be doing up here? He walked around the platform again, more slowly this time. He had missed something. There was something here he was supposed to see, to find. Under the bar there was a row of cupboards. He opened them one by one. Glasses, cleaning products, paper rolls for the till, a Canopic jar. Oh no. He grabbed it from the bottom shelf of the end cupboard, a crude clay jar with a falcon head top. Oh no, please, God, no. He turned it this way and that, looking for the killer's message, but there was no scroll attached to this jar. He didn't want to think about what might be inside it, but he couldn't stop himself. He retched as he tried to prise off the lid, grasping the bird's beak and trying to twist it. It was stuck fast. He staggered to his feet, clutching the jar. Seized by a tremendous rage, he threw it against the curved window. The jar shattered and fell to the floor. The thick glass window was unmarked. Francis stared at the shards of clay, expecting to see a mess of bloody flesh. But there was nothing except the dried orange pottery and a small creamy roll of papyrus.
Oh my gosh, I was literally on the edge of my seat then. Thank you so much, Alison. I'm so excited to read this series. How can people find you, follow you, and get their hands on a copy of your excellent trilogy?
Well, I'm on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook as Alison Belsham. So if you, you know, if you search them for Alison, at Alison Belsham, they'll come up. I have a website, which is alisonbelsham.com. There's nothing like trying to keep it simple. And of course, the books are available on all the usual, you know, from Amazon, on the Waterstones website, anywhere, you know, anywhere that you can, where you would normally order your books, you should be able to search and find them.
Oh, well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Darren Kay is the author of The Brightonians. Darren lived in Brighton many years ago in the 90s, then moved away to London and then came back, and his new book is out now. Darren, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Why this book?
I was really inspired by a project that I worked on with the Brighton Museum, actually. It's called Queer the Pier, which is a celebration of 200 years of queer history in Brighton and Sussex, and it's actually still on. You can still go and see it. It's been on now for nearly 3 years. And I think one of the things that really struck me when I was working on that project was how history presented in a museum is not really not for everyone, you know, it's not everyone's cup of tea. And we really made an effort in that exhibition to create installations that would appeal to people who don't just want to go and read loads of stuff in a cabinet. So we had lots of interactive games. And I just thought, actually, one thing that really struck me was how much of queer history is being lost because it's not really presented in a way that sort of that other, you know, that people can digest. And I think, you know, that was my inspiration. I thought, oh, why not capture queer history in a novel? And then, you know, people are more likely to sort of, you know, some people are more likely to sort of embrace that and find it enjoyable and you know, want to learn more.
So let's talk about the plot of The Brightonians. What happens in this book?
OK, well, it's basically, as the title suggests, it's about a group of Brightonian socialites, and they're already warring. They're already vying for supremacy of the social circle when the book opens. But then one of them accidentally comes across a 50-year-old letter belonging to a local drag queen, and the sort of, the, you know, the race to find out what happened to the people in this letter takes their catapults their sort of social competitiveness to new and increasingly ridiculous levels.
So you really mix there your kind of love and knowledge of social history with your knowledge and love of Brighton and queer culture here.
Yeah, completely. It is. I've always had a passion for history, and I just really wanted to also capture Brighton in 2000. Well, it's set in 2019 with flashbacks to the 1960s, but I really wanted something to capture the vibrancy of Brighton, particularly the queer scene in Brighton right now. You know, in the way. Obviously, you know, Armistead Maupin, you know, we discussed that you're named after Anna from Tales of the City. I think that one of the joys of the Maupin books is that he was writing about San Francisco actually in his own time. You know, it was a very much, you know, from the magazine, from the newspaper, it was things happening right then. And I just thought, I really wanted to capture Brighton as I see it right now. You know, and that was my real drive, because I just like everyone in Brighton, we love Brighton.
We very much do. And I've seen you speak before about the kind of link between Tales in the City and San Francisco and Kemp Town in Brighton. Do you see those parallels quite clearly?
Oh, completely. I think that I think that San Francisco in the 70s, it really captured a moment in queer history. I think it was that moment where it was post Stonewall. So you had this sort of sexual revolution. It was a period before HIV and AIDS. And so there was a period of huge hopefulness. And I think that Brighton has elements of that now. I think, you know, we're in a, you know, obviously we've got lots of struggles ahead, you know, particularly with the, you know, the changes in the political spectrum at the moment. But, you know, I do think that when you walk around Brighton, it is very unique. It is a place where freedom is almost, you know, blazoned on every street corner. And, you know, it's very, you know, it's very unusual in that sense.
Absolutely. Can you read us some,
please, Darren? Yeah, because I think one of the things that I was really keen to do in the novel was, you know, we talked about Armistead Maupin and how those books for me were very much, I used them as a guide. When I went to San Francisco in the mid-90s, I used his books as a guide to San Francisco, and, you know, did pilgrimage to Barbary Lane and, you know, all the Coit Tower and all these other places. And so I was really keen that I used real places in the book, so that anyone reading the book, then coming to visit Brighton, they could go and you know, do a little bit of a stroll round. And I, one of the places that I feature in the book, or not feature, but one of the places I mention is the adult shop on St. James's Street, which is called Nice and Naughty. And I actually went in there before the book started published, and I said, "Oh, you know, I feature your shop in the book. Would you allow me to use the real name?" And they said, "Oh no, absolutely, we'd love to." Because it was originally for a couple of years, it was a made up name. It was called Stuffed and Mounted, and so I was so pleased to be able to refer to it as by its real name, Nice and Naughty. And it's quite appropriate because now the shop has moved online, so the shop no longer exists anymore. And anyone in Brighton who's been here for a few years will remember the very, very fabulous window displays that Nice and Naughty would put up. And they would celebrate every single sort of, you know, Valentine's Day, Christmas, Halloween, whatever. The showroom dummies would be dressed in the style. And so in the book, the two showroom dummies, I've called them Charles and Diana. and I was so thrilled because actually when the book came out, one of the places where the book was being sold was actually in Nice and Naughty, and I actually managed to get the book shoved down the shorts of one of the showroom dummies. So it was an amazing product placement. So anyway, this is the scene. So the main thing that kicks the whole story off is Brighton's former MP, Britain's first ever trans MP, Grace Davidson, has died peacefully in her sleep. She's 84 or something like that. So the whole town goes into mourning. You know, and it's actually quite weird because after I'd written the book, James Ledwood died far too young, and actually when I went to the service at St Mary's, it was very similar to how I'd written the service for Grace. So it was almost It was very odd. I mean, you know, there's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? Sort of life imitating fiction and stuff, but it was very much like that. So anyway, this scene is where Grace has died. She's a very much loved person in the town, and the whole of Kemp Town has suddenly gone into mourning. So this is a conversation between two of the main characters, Ollie, who's a gym instructor, and Cameron, who is an ad man. Obviously, a lot of Cameron's experience is influenced by my own. So, October 2019. OMG, squealed Ollie down the phone. Aye, Grace Davidson, I know. They announced it on the train, replied Cameron to his friend. No, I mean, OMG, St. James's Street. St. James's Street, way, what's happened? Hang on a minute, I'll send you a picky, replied Ollie, striding over to the window. One moment, caller, he sang down the phone before opening the camera and zooming into the shop window of Nice and Naughty on the other side of the street. Known throughout Brighton for their arresting window displays, Ollie's focus today was not, however, their impressive selection of latex underwear, harnesses and rubber fetish gear. Instead, he picked out the two showroom dummies wrapped from head to toe in black bedsheets. Photo taken, Ollie sent it to Cameron and returned to his sofa. Look, even Charles and Diana are in mourning, he trilled into his phone. Jesus Christ, no, that's priceless, replied Cameron. I know, but I bet Diana's still wearing the sexy maid's outfit she's had on all week. Aye, though it does look like someone's at least taken the dildo out of Charles's jockstrap. And is that a photo of Grace I see on the wee pedestal? So, yeah, I just love the fact that, you know, that it's now been encapsulated somehow in you know, forever will exist, at least in a book, if not actually on St. James's Street anymore.
Absolutely. You talking about that and the sad closing down of the shop, the physical shop, has really made me think about how much Brighton must have changed for you in the time when you lived here, you know, 30 years ago than when you came back. Could you talk a bit about that?
I think in 1990, obviously, you know, in terms of queer politics, yes, I mean, you know, it was still when I was going out with someone in Brighton then, and actually, you know, in theory, we were actually still illegal. I was, you know, but my boyfriend was 19, so you know, the age of consent didn't change until. I think sort of 1997, 96, 97. I know it kind of came down in a couple of stages. Obviously, we were very much in the thick of the HIV and AIDS epidemic, crisis, pandemic, whatever you want to call it. You know, and that was very, very, very obvious in Brighton. You know, Brighton was hit very badly by it having such a big queer community. But I think, you know, I think in terms of how it's changed physically, I will say one thing. I remember the very first Pride. Now I actually moved back to London, but it was, I think the very first Pride was 1992. If you discount the one in 1973 where they discovered recently, I was on that march, and what I remember was being really quite frightened being on the actual march itself, and really couldn't wait to get to Preston Park. It was like, oh, thank God that's over with. We can actually party. And, you know, there was virtually no one stood on the sidelines, you know, cheering us. It was very much more of a sort of a protest, a statement of being here. And like, you know, I was on the float for the Brighton Museum just this time, where we actually, myself and a few of the people, we celebrated the 1973 march with banners that said things like sodomy is cool and Sussex Gay Liberation Front, glad to be gay, all that kind of stuff. I mean the difference is phenomenal. You know you've seen it, you're on that float, and there's, you know, tens of thousands of people cheering you on. And you know, the difference is phenomenal in what we talk in 20, you know, 30 years. I mean, it's a huge change. You know, and that's, you know, one of the things I love about Brighton is when in London going on Pride marches, they were great, but you almost felt like you were a bit of an inconvenience. You know, people wanted to get the road back so they could, you know, keep driving. Whereas in Brighton, Pride weekend, the whole place just completely shuts down, doesn't it? You know, really, I feel like the whole town is behind, you know, the celebrations that weekend. It's such a You know, so that would, if, you know, if you're looking for a difference, that I think really shows the difference from me being terrified to actually dancing on a float and, you know, being in the thick of it, even as a 56-year-old man. Great fun.
Absolutely. Did you find out anything? I could talk to you for weeks, Darren, so I'm really going to, this is going to be my last question. Could you find any facts about Brighton that you just were completely shocked by?
Oh gosh. I mean, because working on Queer the Pier, we unearthed so much stuff. Really good question. Because my mind immediately goes to lots of historical stuff. I think one that really, really stands out, the aquarium, which is the oldest aquarium in the world, I believe, which is now the Sea Life Centre. Back in the 1950s, when it was still called the Brighton Aquarium, there was something there called the Sussex Arts Ball. And this was basically a drag ball. And there were stories of people. In fact, I took around to Queer the Pier. I took around the oldest guest I've ever taken around, a chap called Michael's, 95 years old, lived in Brighton since the 50s. He actually remembered going to that ball and actually how men would sit on the gay beach, which was actually on Hove Lawns back then in the 50s, and would spend afternoons sewing on sequins onto their dresses, feathers onto their headpieces. And this was 1956. And I think we sometimes have an idea that Brighton has suddenly become very gay. I think, you know, it was obviously under the radar. But there was always a bit of a sort of, it's been a magnet for many, many years. As Beth and Roberts, in a fabulous novel, touches on, the late 50s and the subculture, the clandestine world of queer pubs and clubs. Yeah.
Absolutely. Darren, how can we find and follow you and grab a copy of The Fabulous Brightonians?
Yes, very easy. On Instagram, it's at Darren K. Author, Darren K. just on Facebook. There are signed copies still in the I360 gift shop, Brighton Museum gift shop, and City Books. And Waterstones have some as well, but they're not signed. And then just obviously all the usual online places.
Our book club book this month is The Pharmacist by Rochelle Atala. This is a beautifully written, gripping, speculative novel set in the not-so-distant future. Atala seems to be able to write the scary and sinister alongside the mundane and heartwarming with pinpoint precision. I could hardly put this book down and finished it in less than a day. Rochelle, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us about The Pharmacist?
Yes, of course. So The Pharmacist is narrated by a character called Wolf, who is the pharmacist in the bunker. She spends her days rather monotonously doling out medication to the other inhabitants while they wait for the outside world to heal. But when the paranoid and erratic political leader of the bunker takes a shine to Wolf, he says, "If you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back and make your existence more bearable," questions of morality, corruption, and survival come into play.
Why speculative in genre? What is it about this that fascinates you?
Well, I don't think I'd set out to actually write a speculative novel. I stumbled into a bunker in 2016 and it kind of consumed my thoughts when I saw this huge space in Berlin, the fact that we governments and wealthy people build these spaces for mutual destruction. So that was the kind of seed and the inspiration. But I suppose with speculative fiction, what I've realised is that you can ask really interesting and I think important questions about society in a world that is slightly removed from our own. I think it's easier to explore those themes rather than in the world that we currently live. But as you said, like, I was quite conscious that I wanted it to be, yes, this isn't a world that we live in, but it could be a world that we live in. So yeah, that appeals to me.
Yeah, there's something about it that feels very timely. So I was going to ask you how current world events and the society that we live in kind of help you form your ideas.
Very much. I think I've said in other interviews that I'm quite a worrier. Like, I lie in bed at night, kind of worrying about the state of the world. And I also think that because I quite often want to seek control for my own worry, I think a way of controlling that in one sense is by able to put it down on page and kind of understand those worries and be able to articulate them through fiction. But at the time when I started writing The Pharmacist, there was a particular president in power in America, and there was a lot of chat about nuclear war. And I would lie in bed thinking, gosh, we put these types of people into positions of power that are very self-serving and actually never pay for the consequences. They'll always be protected. And it's kind of Joe Public that pay the price. And I thought there was something really interesting about the fact that that was just quite a normal thing that we had to accept. And it is asking the question of human worth, you know, who is more important than someone else, and why is that? So I think politics, whether I want it to or not, politics kind of simmer into the writing.
So before I ask you to read some, can you tell us a bit about Wolf, who she is, why she is the way she is, you know, why she's in the bunker, and how you wrote her?
I feel like Wolf came to me when I knew I wanted to write a novel about a bunker. It took me a while to figure out the voice and who was going to carry this voice. I was very conscious that I wanted to have it in first person narration, and I wanted it to be this unreliable person, because I felt that we're kind of all the unreliable narrators of our own lives. And I liked the idea that you're only getting Wolf's perspective. So it might not always be the right perspective, but that's the only perspective that you're getting. So I knew I needed a voice that could kind of carry that weight. And I played around for a while. When I landed on Wolf's voice, it just felt very, very natural. And I used to be a community pharmacist, and I found a lot of the little details and intricacies kind of pouring out of me into her. I mean, we're very different people. I'd like to think she's a lot more flawed than I am. And the things that she's willing to do are not things I would have hoped I'd ever been in a position to want to think about. But I just found her to be a really interesting character. I liked spending time with her. I wanted her to have this kind of dejected tone, where she's just kind of having to pull herself through this existence. And as the novel progresses, she realizes actually the power that she herself holds, and particularly by being a pharmacist.
Can you read us some, please?
Of course. So I'm going to read from chapter 4, and the generators are just about to go off in the bunker, plunging the entire place into darkness. I stared up at Canavan's bunk, making out its sunken shape in the blue nightlight glow, when the generators cut out, plunging the entire bunker into total darkness. The power cuts usually only lasted minutes, but knowing this didn't make it any easier. I gripped my blankets and tried to visualize something that could trick me into distraction. I thought about the huge shopping mall and multi-story car park that sat directly above us. I treated myself to some lovely boyfriend-style jeans and eaten ramen noodles with Officer Holden while his wife was at work. He couldn't operate his chopsticks, and I'd reveled in his having to ask for a fork. I so clearly remembered the feel of his hand gripping my thigh under the table. I shifted position. I could hear people breathing, quick and erratic, while a child cried out in the distance for her mother. I brought my hand up in front of my face, but I couldn't make it out. We'd been told this particular bunker has 0.2% of the city's population, the country's best minds huddled together. But in reality, it was mostly populated by politicians and bankers, the odd media mogul thrown in for good measure. They had had enough money and influence to protect themselves and their loved ones, but there was nothing particularly special or impressive about any of them. Where were the experts in science or academia? Could I assume that they were safe in another of the city's bunkers? We were in a poor mix of a gene pool too. My mum's North African heritage within me must have been missed on admission, pale enough to slip through the net when combined with the gift of a Western surname. When I was little, I used to force my parents to put their arms next to each other. The contrast and the complexions fascinated me. My brother and I, a perfect blend of them both.
It's such beautiful writing. I urge everybody to read this book. So I'd really like to talk a little bit about world building. Something has happened on the outside, and everyone is in the bunker waiting for the world to repair for, is it 36 months?
Yeah, 3 years of this.
Do you know what happened on the outside? And is that something that you're willing to share with us?
I imagine that it is nuclear war, because I think that is something that could potentially happen. But I never wanted to specifically say. I mean, I think there's moments where she talks about kind of isotopic half-lives and things like that. But she doesn't ever see what's happened. She's kind of in the bunker because they have followed this leader, kind of like the Pan Piper, to safety. And as far as they are concerned, they are the lucky ones. They're the ones that get to live. And I don't have a solid answer. I don't know what happened in the world. I just know Wolf's little contained world within the bunker. I assume it's nuclear disaster. However, I like the ambiguity. I like the fact that actually Wolf, whether it gives her comfort or not, has the opportunity to question, are they the lucky ones, or actually are they the ones that are kind of, is it like a coup? Have they been removed as kind of the worst of the world? And I think sometimes that offers comfort to her and sometimes it's distressing, but I think it deserves to have that kind of ambiguity. I come from short story writing, and there's always room left for the reader to kind of make their own assumptions and interpretations. And I think that style of writing is something I very much wanted to transfer over into my novel.
Absolutely. What are the big differences for you between moving from short story writing to novel writing?
Apart from the obvious length. I suppose when I came to writing the novel, I just thought, is this something I'm capable of? Can I sustain this story for 95,000 words? And I think as well, because I chose to write something that was contained in one space, so you've got your limitations.
Thank you for listening to the Writing Book Club. So you can download this episode from wherever you get your podcast from.
I'm very much of the mantra to start the story as late as possible and get
our book club book next month is Gabrielle Zevin's Tomorrow. I cannot wait to.
I wanted to be something that felt quite precise and kind of controlled, and I wanted the reader to feel like the world already existed when they start reading from page one. It's a world that's already familiar to Wolf and the other inhabitants. So it's a different discipline in the sense that you are having to sustain and think about your characters for a lot longer. But actually, I think the foundations of short story writing really help you. I think if you can tell a story in 2,000 words and make someone feel something in that short space, and then you can transfer that to a longer form.
Absolutely. What are you working on next?
A few things. I'm just about to sign off the typeset edit on my second novel, which is called Thirsty Animals. And that should be out next spring, I believe. That's another, I would say it's kind of a literary speculative novel about water. So it's set on a livestock farm in the Scottish borders. And it's about how we behave around water and what happens to society when it becomes a kind of scarce and sacred commodity. So more kind of climate related. So that's, I'm just about to finish that off, and then that's me, I'm done. And I'm working on some screenwriting projects at the moment as well.
Well, so exciting. So for anyone listening that thinks, oh, I have an idea about writing something speculative or dystopian, you know, in that kind of general genre, what would your advice be?
I think you would, if you feel compelled, then absolutely put pen to paper. I would say that it does take a lot of time and research. You have to be, particularly when you're writing something that involves world building, or you're asking the audience to kind of go along with this world that doesn't exist yet. It really has to be watertight. You know, people will gladly pick it apart. So I think you really need to know what is the world before you commit to it, make sure it's something that you feel passionate enough to kind of carry on with, and something that you can sustain, because it's going to be a long road. Writing a novel is a real commitment, but I think as long as you're passionate and you're excited about the project and the idea, then you've got to go for it, really.
Thank you so much for joining us, Rochelle. How can we find and follow you and grab a copy of this excellent novel?
So the novel, I believe, is in all bookstores and all online, so you can order it from the usual places. I am on Twitter. My handle is Rochelle_ATA. I'm on Instagram as well, I think, just as Rochelle Atala. So yeah, give me a follow, and I hope you enjoy if you pick up the book. Precious.